You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I'm Matt and I'm joined by my good friend Magga, and we'll once again be talking about films, TV series, books, music, games, anything that caught our attention over the last couple of weeks. How have you been doing, Magga?
I've been great, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine. I mean, spring is now properly here for the moment, although it keeps switching between sunshine and rain. But I think that's always a good excuse to stay in at least some of the time and watch some good TV, read some good books, anything like that. So what have you been reading, watching, playing, listening to over the last couple of weeks?
I've watched Ozark. So far, it's a one season story. I think it has 9 or 10 episodes, 1 hour long. It sounds pretty generic, almost boring on paper. It's about a financial advisor called Marty Bird, played by Jason Bateman, who is very good at his job. He could almost be some kind of forensic accountant. He can read numbers like other people can read texts. He has a financial advisory firm with his partner, and they get bullied into laundering drug money for a Mexican drug cartel.
As one does, yes.
Yeah, it happens, especially in South Chicago. And without Marty's knowledge, his partner Bruce skims off drug money. He can't resist the temptation. And he gets killed, and Marty almost meets the same fate, except he can talk his way out of it, and the drug lord from Mexico, he tells him, okay, I'm not going to kill you, I'm not going to kill your family, just make me $500 million over the summer. Mm-hmm. When fall arrives, I want to see my money. And Marty Bird has to gain money by any means necessary. It sounds mediocre, not very interesting. What makes it very interesting are the performances. Jason Bateman, Laura Linney. There are some very good plot twists. They have to put up with unexpected resistance from the locals in Ozark, Missouri. There is not much possibility to sort of launder that amount of money in any way. It's country. It's a southern state. And Marty Bird soon encounters a whole lot of resistance, of problems. They don't like him very much. He's an outsider. It's very well done. It's highly entertaining. Jason Bateman is great at timing. He's a very smooth talker, if you let him. He's some kind of everyman. I like that about him. I mean, he was the only sane guy in Arrested Development. All the others were psychos, delusions of grandeurs.
I mean, it does sound to me a bit like, I don't know, it very much sounds like post-Breaking Bad TV. I mean, premise of, you know, drug crime and a normal person who becomes embroiled in it. Does it feel, or does it watch anything like Breaking Bad? It's also on Netflix, by the way, right?
It is on Netflix, yeah. It often gets compared to Breaking Bad. I don't think it's as good as Breaking Bad. It sometimes loses some of its appeal because it is, at some point, it is repetitive. You know, you have to launder money, you get found out, you have to find another possibility, then you launder some more. Other people get suspicious. What makes it interesting is that Marty Bird is incapable of a lie. He'd rather not talk about what he does, but when he has to come out, he comes out. Otherwise, people get hurt. There's some kind of bedrock honesty about him. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's gonna turn in any kind of Walter White. He's not gonna be any kind of intimidating drug enforcer or drug lord. He doesn't have that in him. He must tell the truth at some point, and he does.
So he's not an anti-hero in that sense?
Well, it depends. He's very quick to tell his children what he does. Of course, they're completely scared and think their dad has lost the plot. They're right. But Marty Bird tries to to be honest as much as he can. I mean, his situation is a completely dishonest one. But he tells people to their faces, look, I'm laundering drug money for a Mexican drug cartel. Are you in? Are you out? That's part of the appeal of the series, I think.
Mm-hmm. Is it, what, one season so far? Two seasons? Is it still continuing?
It's continuing. There is, well, season one is out. It's done. But season two might bring much more trouble than season one. There is one weird aspect of Ozark. There is a local, shall we say, drug dealer already before Marty Bird arrives. And he's played by Peter Mullen. And Peter Mullen is Scottish, and he has a kind of southern US accent, and that just rubs me the wrong way. It's a personal problem. Other people might not see it as an obstacle.
Yeah.
To me, he has some kind of Scottish accent. I can't really place it because I don't know about Scottish accent too much. But he sort of has that southern drawl, and that's just, it's wrong coming out of his mouth. Can't help
exactly. I mean, I like actors who have a wide range and everything, and I like Peter Mullen, but yes, Peter Mullen, I think for me, is very archetypically Glaswegian. I think within that Glaswegian thing that he does, he's got a fair range, but him doing anything else, that would be a bit like, I don't know, it would be like Bill Murray rapping. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. What have you seen lately?
Just last night we watched Jodorowsky's Dune, the documentary about the making of, or rather not making of, well, yeah, Alejandro Jodorowsky's adaptation of Dune. It's a great film. It's actually a great fun film. It's surprisingly fun because it's, you know, you don't necessarily think of documentaries as fun. And I would actually put it, you know, in a group with films like Lost in La Mancha, the film about Terry Gilliam trying to and failing to make The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, which now is actually coming out.
Yeah,
it's also in line with films like Hearts of Darkness, a documentary about Apocalypse Now. And it's just great to hear these mostly kind of insane, obsessed people talking about how they tried to make this film, and it was not just a film, it was going to be a prophet of a film that basically rings in the new age. And it's clear that these people must have been completely off their heads on drugs, or perhaps their drug was actually their ego. And I've never seen any of Jodorowsky's films, and I'm not even sure whether after seeing this documentary I would want to watch any of his films. But it's definitely entertaining just to hear about the making of this film that then doesn't come about. It's a kind of story that could be tragic. I think that, for instance, Lost in La Mancha has this comic, tragic thing going. But this one is basically just fun because these people were and still kind of are kind of crazy. I mean, it's telling that Hans Rediger, the guy who designed The Alien, is probably almost the most normal and sedate person in the film. But they come out of it okay. It doesn't feel like they came out of it kind of damaged or depressed or feeling that they'd lost it somehow. Mm-hmm. They felt they had a chance, they worked together, they produced something, at least on paper. And that something, at least according to the film, went on to provide inspiration for so many other filmmakers. I'm not quite sure to what extent I believe that last part, but it's kind of uplifting, which you don't expect when it comes to a documentary about a film that didn't come about.
All right.
So that's one thing I watched. One other thing I've read, perhaps just to quickly mention that, I reread for the second time Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose, and it's one of those books. I have these films and books that I read them or I watch them and I don't actually like them all that much. But I keep thinking it's not them, it's me. And perhaps if I try again in a couple of years' time, it will be different. With Name of the Rose, I actually saw the film when I was 12 years old, which was, I would say, a very formative experience. I think I probably learned everything I know about sex from seeing The Name of the Rose and seeing Christian Slater getting it on as a medieval monk. And the book, it's not bad, But Echo has this thing of, he obviously knows a hell of a lot, but he also enjoys telling everyone that he knows a hell of a lot. The story keeps being interrupted by lectures, I would say, about the situation of the church in the Middle Ages, the whole schism, the two popes, the basically Catholic Church almost falling apart. And that's interesting up to a point, but at a certain point it feels like, yeah, we've now heard enough about Fra Dolcino, we've heard enough about the anti-pope, let's get on with the story, shall we? And as I said, I've now read it for the third time. I get something out of it, but at the same time I was glad when I'd finished it, and I keep thinking, yeah, I think I prefer the film, because the film, while it's clearly dumbed down to a certain extent, you could say, it doesn't try to teach its audience about the Middle Ages and the Catholic Church. But I think that's actually fine. I think it's a great story, it's an exciting story, and the changes that are made make sense. Sean Connery is nothing like the character in the novel, but it's a great part for Sean Connery. I mean, especially now that he's not acting anymore, I'm quite glad that we can look back at parts like this one and enjoy them. So I think I will probably rewatch the film. I might reread the novel in 10 years' time, but let's see what else comes up in the meantime.
I think I read The Name of the Rose when I was very young, and I didn't know anything about the Great Schism, so I couldn't figure out what was going on, except somebody killed some monks.
that is definitely the case. I mean, monks do get killed in the novel and in the film.
Yeah.
And they get put in vats of blood, and they get drowned and poisoned, and they read a lot. I mean, you know, man does not live off monk murder alone, I guess. I think apart from the dead monks and the crazy Mexican directors, what have you brought along this month?
I've brought along Legion. We are shortly before season 2 of Legion. It's a TV series. It's a Marvel TV series, but I think it's very much for those who wouldn't want to be seen dead watching some kind of superhero movie. It's for those who want to cross the street if they even see an Avengers poster or something like that, because it's it is very, very much not how to put it. It is unlike all the other series. It is not like Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, and what have you. It starts really rather early. It takes one of the characters from the Marvel universe. I know it's complicated. I'm not going to use the term Marvel any longer. But it takes one of the characters and has a long, hard look at him in a very madcap way. Talk about Jodorowsky in a way. His name is David Haller. He's told that he has mental problems, that he's sort of crazy, he's acting out. He also has real-world problems, like trouble with his girlfriend. He does drugs with other people, and he ends up in a mental hospital. Of course, he doesn't want to be there, but since he, to some extent, acknowledges that he has mental problems, he's really rather all right being there as well, in a sense. We don't know at the beginning of the series what kind of powers or superpowers he has, and that's a large part of the fun, finding that out.
Yeah. I mean, in the very first episode, I would even say you don't even know whether he has any powers, because as you say, in the first episode, you could think he's probably schizophrenic. He hears voices. He doesn't seem to have any control over it. And at the beginning, you could just think, okay, this is going to be a mind trip. It's basically a trip into the mind of a man who is insane to some extent.
Yeah. I think to me, the appeal of the series is that you sometimes just don't know where you stand. There are scenes that appear to be real, happening before your eyes, but yet there's something weird about them, something inexplicable. Other scenes are read as memories. The thing is, are they sort of reconstructed memories? There is a mechanism that lets you reconstruct memories. Are we in a memory right now? Is it a genuine memory? Or is something hidden in the memory Or is it a daydream? Whose daydream is it? Has something manipulated that daydream too? Anything can happen, basically. It sounds like a big buffet of ideas. And yet there is some kind of red thread in there. It manages to be completely surprising all the time and with a kind of story. I've watched the whole season one twice and I still can't figure out a lot of stuff, but it keeps me interested. I want to see what changes and where. There are questions that are still unanswered. Of course there are, because there's a season two and we want to know what happens to David Haller and that little group of people who want to help him. The government is after him. There's a kind of, what do they call themselves? Division 3.
Mm-hmm.
They either want to use his superpowers for themselves, or if he gets too dangerous, they want to isolate him or neutralize him. And that's, of course, a euphemism for killing him. He himself just wants to try and learn to control his powers, and then we'll see, basically. He wants to get sane. He just wants to be with his girlfriend, who's named Sid Barrett. How cool is that? So,
yeah. No, but I'm not sure I would 100% subscribe to what you say. I like a good Marvel movie, but I also like this one. I think, you know, mm-hmm. it is an untypical superhero story, absolutely. But
yeah.
I think it doesn't completely ignore all the trappings of the genre. But at the same time, it's very far away from the capes and mechanical suits and the, I don't know, laser guns. It's definitely not like that. I think what it does very differently, I think, from most of the superhero stuff that we've seen over the last decade or so, is that in its style and in its storytelling, it's utterly subjective. It's very much from the perspective of individuals who are not entirely trustworthy, who cannot entirely trust their mm-hmm. senses very often. I think, as you said, you know, we often don't know the exact reality of what we see. Is that something that's manipulated by someone's mind? Is it mm-hmm. manipulated by one of the characters? In that respect, actually, I think there is a certain kinship to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which of course tells a completely different story, a much more romantic story and a much more Charlie Kaufman story. But you have this same thing where basically memories are a part of someone's identity, but identities are not stable. Identities keep changing. Mm-hmm. Who you think you are, who you want to be, that keeps changing. You can shape that yourself, but it's also shaped by others. And it's shaped in, you know, weird, fantastic, utterly stylistic ways. And I think that's one of the things that I liked best about Legion. I think it's a series that looks like nothing else on TV. It doesn't even look like anything else in the movies. There's perhaps a slight touch of, I don't know, Wes Anderson in how stylistic it is. But even that comparison doesn't really work, because Wes Anderson, his stuff is always extremely cleaned up and extremely controlled. And there's a chaotic edge to Legion that I really like. It's utterly stylistic, but there's always this threat of losing control over what's going on, over the different elements. The series can explode in a musical sequence out of nowhere. And when it happens, you think, what the hell? And then the next moment you think, no, actually, this is the only thing that makes sense at this point. Mm-hmm. And it does that amazingly well. The guy who created it, what's his name again?
I think it's Noah Hawley,
Exactly, that's it.
That right. Yeah.
He also did Netflix Fargo series, right?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Exactly, and I watched the first season of that, and didn't really warm to it. So I think when I heard that he's doing a series that's set in the Marvel Universe, I was not pessimistic. I just thought, yeah, well, let's see what's happening. But while Fargo season one didn't work for me, with this one, I really think, wow, I've really seen a TV series that has such a strong creator signature style that is just from the first episode. It doesn't take 3-4 episodes to take it to find its feet. Mm-hmm. Basically, from the first episode, Legion, the universe, the characters, the style, the feel, the atmosphere, it's there, and that I found quite amazing.
Yeah, yeah. There are one or two touches of Legion-like storytelling in Fargo. There is a moment where the Kieran Culkin character is maybe abducted by aliens, but there's no proof. So that I could imagine that was not in the screenplay at all. It's also, I think, a throwaway scene. And I think Noah Hawley wants us to, you know, I could let go of the reins and just have fun with that. And he he suggests, yeah, I'm going to abduct one character. I'm going to have it abducted by aliens. In Legion, as long as he sort of adheres loosely to the storyline, he can do what he wants. I mean, there are scenes where a woman, probably Syd Barrett, is singing an a cappella version of Road to Nowhere off screen. There's something else happening on screen. Fantastic scenes like that. I mean, you have to have complete freedom to insert 80s pop songs in some sort of superhero series. I find that fantastic. Of course, since she's called Syd Barrett, you're waiting for a Pink Floyd song to come up, and it will somewhere in episode 2 or even episode 1. I'm not sure. They play The Who. They play the Bolero for a certain reason, because it will save lives. It has fantastic ideas. It's brimful of well thought out ideas, and it's constantly surprising. Mm-hmm. Also, the architecture of the psychiatric clinic, you know, those corridors that branch off weirdly. Mm-hmm. It's ingenious how it looks. Yeah. The weird doors and the the ping pong table without the ping pong ball, things yeah. like that.
I mean, one thing I find really fascinating is at first you think, okay, is this series set in the 60s? You look at the fashion, you look at the colors, mm-hmm. you look at how people look, hairdos. And then you realize, no, but they've got tablet computers, they've got modern army technology. And then you realize it's this weird eclectic mix of times and cultures and places that should not be coherent in any way, yet it is. And I think that also represents David's mind quite well. I mean, this is a guy who thinks he's insane, he's schizophrenic, he hears voices. Mm-hmm. He's constantly trying to hold on to some kind of core self of his. Yet all of these different things that make him up, the voices, the memories, the characters, the ideas, it all still comes together into a coherent whole. Yeah. Not necessarily a clear, unambiguous whole. No, not at all. I mean, it's even when you know that he's got powers and everyone tells him, no, you're not insane. You're telepathic and you're telekinetic and you're a mutant, David. You have to say that, you know, functionally, you have to wonder how much difference is there. If you hear mm-hmm. voices, even if they're real voices, as long as you don't have 100% control over it, how different is that from schizophrenia? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the power fantasy superhero story that we're used to. And I think that is really, really cool. It's the powers don't make David a better person. They don't make him a stronger person. They do in some ways, but they especially make him a more dangerous person and a person who's more at danger of completely falling apart and losing it.
Mm-hmm.
Which yeah. could sound like a complete downer. I mean, put that in the hands of, I don't know, someone like the people who do the DC comic movies, and it would be, you know, kind of grimdark, but this is not grimdark at all. It takes, I think, the character seriously, while at the same time having fun with them. Again, two things that very rarely work together so well, but they work together so well in this one. Mm-hmm. And I think what especially impresses me is that there's lots of superhero TV series, especially Netflix has done all of these Marvel series, from Daredevil to Luke Cage to Jessica Jones to Iron Fist. Let's not talk about him anymore, but yeah, the man who shall not be named. And those series, they have their good moments, they have their bad moments, especially Jessica Jones is quite good. But none of them are as assured. None of them have as clear a vision of what they want to do. None of them are as unique or as interesting or as watchable as Legion is at every single moment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it actually embarrasses Netflix to see how someone else does something so exciting. I would really say exciting with the genre and with the Marvel material. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's part of the X-Men universe, right?
I think it is, yeah, but I think it's important to say you don't have to know anything about the X-Men universe.
Exactly. I think there's the occasional Easter egg, like, for instance, the not quite but almost reveal of who David Holler's dad is.
Yeah.
A certain specific mutant who likes to kind of zoom around in a wheelchair. But that's just really Easter eggs for the fans. It's... you can watch this on its own. You don't even have to know that it's Marvel. It's its own thing completely. And I think it's also good that it's its own thing. It doesn't feel like it wants to do any franchise building, because I think, you know, franchise building has done some interesting stuff for Marvel, but at the same time, not every story has to be a kind of preview trailer teaser for another story.
Yeah, it's true. It definitely does not follow any kind of formula that I'm aware of. I mean, yeah, it is a superhero series. There eventually will be some kind of fights. There will be superpowers, but other than that, it does things that other series wouldn't even dream of. Some characters, they swap roles. It's never quite... you're never quite sure where you are with the characters. As you said, identity is completely fluid in those ones. It is at the same time constantly surprising, but it's never a one-trick pony. Sometimes you get to see a movie where in the end you get the big revelation, you know, the coda and everything, and everything you thought you knew about those characters sort of changes. Legion does that from 5 minutes, 10 minutes into the pilot. So you have to be on your toes to watch it. I think it does not lend itself well to binge watching, because it is simply too damn much to take in. After two episodes, you might be puzzled at the least, and maybe even sort of exhausted. I wouldn't want to watch all of it in one go or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just not that kind of series.
It's too rich, yeah.
Yeah, there's too much in there.
Exactly. I mean, it's an utterly generous series. I mentioned the kind of musical sequence before, and you might think, okay, there's one musical sequence, but I think there's about four of them, and each of them is completely different. It's, again, I think that's a huge contrast to the Netflix superhero series, which they're long, but they're not generous. You basically get the same character beats, the same plot beats, over and over again in some of them. You watch one episode of Daredevil and you've almost seen them all. You've watched one episode of He Who Shall Not Be Named, and you definitely don't feel very keen to watch the others. Yeah. With Legion, we also watched it. We don't really binge watch stuff all that much, but we watched it basically one episode a week. And that was perfect. Every week I was like looking forward to, what are they going to do this week? What are they going to come up with that's going to surprise me and dazzle me? And they always came up with stuff. I think there's certain episodes that stand out even above the others in terms of what they do. There's a fantastic musical sequence that basically turns the scene into a silent movie. And it's gorgeous. You see certain influences. There's an element there of Tim Burton when he was still good, but there's so many other things. It remixes all of its influences in new and surprising ways. I think I never once during the series thought, yeah, that's a scene I've seen before, either in this series or in another series. I hope they can keep this up. As you said, season two is in the making. I think they actually started showing it in the States. I'm curious to hear how that turns out. I think what people say about the beginning of season two makes it sound like they keep up the level of imagination.
That's good.
But it is definitely the kind of thing that could burn out on itself simply because it burns so brightly.
Yeah, it's possible.
But I mean, I still have great hopes for it, and I'm very much looking forward to season two.
Me too. There, I think we said last time, didn't we, that most of the Marvel series could be pruned by a certain number of episodes.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the series would gain. Legion, you can't do that with Legion. It would lose significantly. It's because there is always some kind of point to the scenes. Even there are certain scenes that get repeated, but there's a point to the repetition. Either there is someone watching it as a repeated memory, or there is some kind of change within the scene, and it's always with a reason that the scene is coming on again and again. Or someone just thinks about it several times because it's a memory. Things like that. Mm-hmm. And I also admire Legion because it can change genres with ease. As you said, that that musical sequence is done black and white and with title cards. And the actors only mouthing their dialogue because the music plays over it. There seems to be a pop video in a very early episode in season two, when I read the trailer correctly. It could also have aspects of a road movie, because certain people are on the run from certain other people. You don't know what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes in any kind of, any episode. That's admirable. There are one-trick ponies that I like. I don't have a problem with watching one-trick ponies. I mean, I mentioned Arrested Development before. You expect the whole Bluth family to be completely gaga, spending money they don't have, you know, having that sense of entitlement, latent schizophrenia, falling in love with your cousin, things like that. You expect them to be completely madcap. And Michael Bluth in the middle trying to make amends and holding the family together. It's a one-trick pony, but it works. Legion does completely different things with sort of mentally special characters, because it uses their dreams and memories, and it lets the subconscious bubble to the surface and let you see things that might not be really there, although they might, which is all the scarier. But at the same time, we can also, to a large part, empathize with David Haller. At least I can. I wouldn't say I've ever been in a situation where I had to say I had a severe mental health problem. But there were times in my life when I thought I was hearing voices, or I was not completely sure whether it was a memory or a dream I was thinking about, or whether the situation I'm in is really an innocent one or a dangerous one, or where I completely and utterly disagreed with everyone around me about a certain aspect, a certain question or whatever. There are similarities between me and so a sort of average person and David Haller, who is not an average person.
It's weird. I think it's probably easy to underestimate Dan Stevens and what he does in Legion, because he is both at the same time a bit of an everyman and someone who basically spent the last couple of years of his life in a mental institution on drugs because he thinks he's schizophrenic. He's relatable, yet he's also out there. And he, again, you've got these kind of two contradictory impulses that are kind of brought together really well in this series. But I think this is perhaps also a good point to talk about the cast in general and the characters. I don't think I've known many of the actors in this series before. I haven't seen Dan Stevens in anything, because I've not seen any of Downton Abbey. And I somehow managed to miss Beauty and the Beast, which I think he was in, right? He was Beast.
I think so, yes.
And I think he's great in this one, but he's not even my favorite actor in it. It's difficult to say who my favorite actor is, because they all do such fantastic jobs. You've got Rachel Keller as Syd Barrett, who you mentioned before. And
yeah.
again, it's easy to underestimate her because you think, okay, the blonde all-American girl next door girlfriend. Yet she's not. She's also messed up in ways that are interesting. And somehow, especially once you get to her power, which is she doesn't like to be touched by people because when she does, she exchanges places with them. And that's used to such fantastic effect, both just in terms of, you know, body switch comedy, but also body switch horror to some extent.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it adds to the character, this girl who seems to be normal and who seems to be the girl next door ideal, who is traumatized, and it works well. I mean, you've got the characters Carrie and Carrie, two characters, a man in his, I would say, 40s, late 40s, possibly early 50s, and Carrie, Native American girl, probably 18 years old, somewhere around there, who share a body. He's basically the one who's mostly their body. That's why he's so much older. Are they siblings? Are they kind of older brother, younger sister? They're very, very different in terms of personality. And I don't think I've ever seen a character or set of characters like the two of them. They're, again, fantastic. Bill Irwin, I think, has been in a number of things. Amber Midthunder, she plays Carrie, she plays the girl. I've never seen her in anything, but she's just so perfect for this character. And then, of course, you've got Jermaine Clement, who was in Flight of the Conchords, who was in What We Do in the Shadows, as a kind of 60s intellectual slash guru slash beat poet. And he has so much fun, and you can't help but have just as much fun watching him with his part. And again, you'd think it should be silly, it should be cartoony, and it is. But somehow they, again, managed to make these characters cartoons, caricatures, outlandish and mad, yet totally relatable.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite character actor in the series?
I think that would be Aubrey Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's she has she makes her acting look some sort of immediate, like she's doing it from the hip. It looks completely unrehearsed, like she just strolled on the set and the camera picked her up by chance, and she's there and doing her stuff. It's a weird combination of being completely herself and being in the scene. I'm not explaining this very well. She's incredibly all over the place, but to some extent that's her task in the series in a way, because she's largely at some point she becomes largely a projection of David Howler. And in other scenes, she's just scary, threatening. I mean, she has in that musical sequence where the series turns black and white for 5 or 6 minutes, she has that weird propped up hair that is scary in itself, and she has she has that look in her eyes that makes you really afraid to look back at her. It's very weird. There's some kind of depth that she doesn't have to, I don't know, she doesn't have to pretend that it's there. It's just there, and that makes her scary to me. I think she's much scarier than, for instance, the Eye, you know, that silent bodyguard kind of type who is sitting in the corner saying nothing, whittling with his knife. He exudes danger, but he's less dangerous than the Aubrey Plaza character in many ways.
Yeah, she is amazing. She is frightening. She is seductive. She's sexy, but never in a kind of cliched, predictable way. She's a total live wire. I would say that, you know, she's not just the best villain in this series, and the series has a couple of villains. I would probably go so far as to say that she's the best villain in any superhero story I've seen or read.
Wow.
I mean, definitely in the Marvel movies, which suffer to some extent from mostly weak villains. I don't think there's anyone I find so exciting yet at the same time frightening to watch as her. In the Netflix series, okay, they've had some good villains. I think that, for instance, David Tennant in Jessica Jones was a very good villain, but he was not such a live wire. I mean, again, she's like the dark side of this series, and she embodies all of its qualities, these kind of very disparate ideas brought together in one mercurial package that can basically strike you as the most drop-down sexy thing and scare you and give you nightmares at the same time. I really can't think of a single other comic book villain, at least in the movies or the TV series, that I would say is as good as her.
Yeah, it's also weird because one moment she's sitting there with glasses and a black turtleneck asking you questions like a psychiatrist, you know. They are questions with a subtext. And then 2 or 3 minutes later or something, she's dancing all over the screen in some sort of lingerie, doing some kind of evocative burlesque show that it seems to be entirely in character still. And that's just amazing. I mean, in both roles, she's sort of credible. When she asks you questions about, you know, your relationship with your mother, and can you tell me more about that? And then 3 minutes later, she's sort of wiggling her assets and doing some kind of lap dance or pole dance or whatever that is. And you can sort of still see what she's trying to get at. It's incredible. Everybody at some point has to do some song and dance. I mean, there's that Serge Gainsbourg French line dance thingy, where even David Haller has a smile on his face and goes like,
"I don't." The Nouvelle Vague Bollywood scene, exactly.
Something like that, yeah. Legion to me is a treasure trove of one good scene after another. It might be good scene in the sense that it's fun, or that it's disturbing, or that it's pulling the rug completely from under you, but there's always some kind of, it does it with some kind of glee, and it's never downtrodden or gruff or grim or anything like that.
Again, the big difference to the Netflix series, which I've enjoyed some of them quite a bit, but Legion is fun. It's so much more fun than any of the other superhero series I've watched recently. And it's not just fun. It's not only ha-ha, you know, fun, exciting, and then you switch it off and you stop thinking about it, because it also gets under your skin. So I think it's daring, it's ambitious, and it's one of the best things that has happened to superhero storytelling on TV or in the movies. I'm not quite sure how the MCU movies could do that, but I kind of hope that they watch Legion and think, okay, let's also be a bit more experimental. Let's also be a bit more risk-taking. I think, you know, the franchise would definitely benefit from that. Doesn't mean that I necessarily want a black and white silent movie musical sequence in
Infinity War.
Exactly, in Infinity War. But I just hope that, you know, they see some of this spark and they think, yeah, let's try something out.
Yeah, yeah. I can't see Thanos singing Mad World or anything like that, but
exactly.
It would benefit, definitely. Yeah.
Absolutely. We want more CGI singing.
Yeah.
Okay, I think this is probably a good point to end on. So for everyone out there who has not watched Legion because they poo-poo superhero stories, do check it out. You might enjoy it. You might not want to cross the street when this one comes along. And by the time we next talk to you guys, I think Infinity War will have been here, right? And we will know whether Thanos sings a ditty or not. So in the meantime, thank you very much, Maga, for this once again very enjoyable hour of talking about films and TV series. You're and welcome. Thank you for everyone out there listening to us. Enjoy your spring. Yeah. Enjoy Thanks. Movies, TV series, books, songs, games. And join us again in a month's time for another damn fine cup of culture. See you around. Bye.
See ya.
Happy Jack wasn't old, but he was a man. He lived in the sand at the Isle of Man. The kids would all sing, he would take a wrong key. So they rode on his head in the furry donkey. The kids come to Jack, they try.